Welcome to Stateside for this snowy cold Thursday. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Great Lakes are at their lowest levels in a decade, in many decades. On today's show, we ask why and what can be done before it wreaks havoc on the region's economy. And did you know a 30-second commercial during the Super Bowl costs $4 million? That's up from $3.5 million last year. And then get this, $42,000 for Super Bowl I in 1967. We talk with two marketing professors who say that most of the car companies are ready to impress. But first, it has been a very, very busy week in Lansing. Let's get the latest now as we check in with State Capitol reporter Jake Neer with the Michigan Public Radio Network. Hi, Jake.
Hi, Cynthia. How are you doing?
Good. Let's start, if we will, with the news that broke earlier today, the ACLU filing suit to strike down right to work. What can you tell us? What's their argument against this?
Well, basically, it comes down to the fact that they say for about 4 hours on the day that Right to Work started moving through the legislature, the doors to the Capitol were closed. People were outside, hoping to get in, and they couldn't. And they say that violates the Michigan Constitution, which guarantees, the residents of Michigan the right to assemble and to instruct their representatives on issues that they find important. And they felt that this violated it, despite the fact that there were people, and it should be mentioned that there were people from the public inside the building at the time. They just weren't letting more people in. Officers basically said that it was a safety issue, that there were too many people in the building at the time.
So, and of course, Governor Snyder, I think, was trying to get a little preemptive strike, wasn't he, by asking the high court, hey, will you rule on the constitutionality of right to work? So that happened a few days ago.
Oh, that's correct. And it's going to be interesting to see what happens with that, too. I have absolutely no idea if the two are related. But certainly it'll be interesting to see how the two cases pan out and if one affects the other.
Let's shift now, Jake, over to the growing push among some in the legislature to change the way that electoral votes are counted at the state level. Just kind of give us a refresher again. What is this debate about?
Well, the people that brought this bill up basically say that they say publicly that they're concerned that a winner-take-all system for electoral votes leaves people in certain parts of the state without a voice. Someone in, Traverse City, let's say, might feel a little like if they want to vote for a Republican, they feel that, because the population in Southeast Michigan tends to go Democrat, that they won't have a voice in the process. So that's the argument.
And who introduced this idea in the first place?
Well, it should be mentioned that as of this point, there's no bill yet this session, but Representative Pete Lund introduced a bill last year before the election, the presidential election. It never really gained much support and never moved.
And Governor Snyder appears to be decidedly cool about all of this, isn't he?
Yeah, he's basically said that now is not the right time, that it would be better to wait until the next census. Basically, this plan would divide up the electoral votes by congressional district. And he says to make it so that it doesn't appear that we're trying to rig the system, that one party would have an unfair advantage over the other one, we should wait until the census when right before the lines are redrawn. So that's his concern. And also it's important to mention that Senate Majority Leader Randy Richardville has also said that he just basically flat out doesn't like the idea. He thinks the winner-take-all system makes the state more interesting to, presidential campaigns during the election season. It's just basically a disagreement in philosophy there.
But how Jace Bolger is saying this is the time to do it when there's not a presidential election at stake. So let's talk now. That's his stance.
That would be, Jace Bolger and House Republicans' stance on this. And I guess I should mention that just because two of the top three Republicans in Lansing are not on board doesn't necessarily mean that this proposal is dead. I mean, we were just talking about right to work. It's a very similar controversial piece of legislation that's been around for a while. It starts to get more attention. Governor Snyder says it's not the right time to take it up. Randy Richardville says he, or at least doesn't seem like he's on board. But, House Speaker Jace Bolger and other Republicans in the legislature, they are pushing for it. And you can definitely see some lines there. So not sure if there's mounting political pressure to pass this like there was with Right to Work. That's yet to be seen. But just basically, don't write this off quite yet.
And of course, it needs to be pointed out that the feeling is, had the system that they want been in place, Mitt Romney could have taken Michigan.
That's correct. The reports that I've seen have said that if we did give out the presidential electoral college votes based on our congressional lines, that's true, that Mitt Romney would have won Michigan and might have won the election across the country.
Continuing our review of things happening in Lansing and at the state capitol, as we are continuing to talk with state capitol reporter Jake Neer with the Michigan Public Radio Network. Let's go over to Blue Cross Blue Shield, Jake. Now, just yesterday, a legislative committee okayed bills to overhaul Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan. And we know this theme. We heard it last year, changing it from a charity to a tax-paying business. And it's certainly something that bears watching when you consider two out of three Michiganders have Blue Cross. Now, what happened last time around was that abortion provision, and that led Governor Snyder to veto the measure in December during lame duck, after the legislation was passed in lame duck. So what's different about these new bills? How would they work?
Well, the abortion language in the bills has been completely taken out. That was something that was added very, very late in the process last year. This time around, basically, the sponsor of the bills, Senator Joe Hewn, said, "We're going to take it out. That's what the governor had a problem with. And we're going to leave everything else pretty much intact. Maybe some very small nuts and bolts type of changes." But that's what we saw. And actually, an update on that, the Senate actually just passed both of the Blue Cross bills today unanimously. And that's something that we didn't see at all as the bills moved through the legislature last session. It seems like there's more support for these bills as they sit now. And, the supporters of the bill and Blue Cross say that it's important for these bills to come through quickly because there's some timing issues when it comes to the possibility of getting some products up on a state exchange or whatever healthcare exchange the state ends up having. So there is a timeliness issue, and there doesn't seem to be much in the way of it at this point.
And certainly, as you point out, this allows Blue Cross to be a part of the exchange that will be part of the Affordable Health Care Act. But here's a question. Is it seen as a changing the way that patients are seen by physicians? Because honestly, what it comes down to, if you have Blue Cross Blue Shield, you want to know, is this going to impact in any way, the cost of what I'm paying for and my ability to see doctors?
Well, the biggest issue came up from AARP and seniors who and Attorney General Bill Schuette's office was also very vocal and still is very vocal about this, that a program that basically pays for some out-of-pocket expenses for seniors on Medicare. After a certain amount of time after these bills take effect, Blue Cross will no longer be required to offer what's called Medigap coverage. And a lot of seniors are very concerned that down the road, their rates are going to either skyrocket or they're not even going to be able to stay with Blue Cross to have the same kind of, same kind of policy that they had before.
Let's move over to gun control. There are some gun-related bills right now that have people talking about how to address that issue of gun control and the issue of mental health in our state. And, of course, lawmakers in Washington are trying to bring around new gun control measures on a federal level. But it does seem as though Michigan might be loosening gun control regulations. There are three gun bills for consideration in the Michigan Senate, and the main bill exempting Michigan-made guns and ammunition from federal arm regulations. The other two bills would exempt gun licensing information from Freedom of Information Act and exempt licensing requirements for some federal firearms dealers. So that's what's up for consideration. What's the latest on the progress?
Right. Yeah, we left off on this last time we talked, and basically what happened is last week they passed very, very quickly out of committee, so far one bill that's a little less controversial that has to do with federal licensing did pass the Senate, but the other two bills which have been getting a lot more attention, the FOIA bill, the Freedom of Information Act bill, and the manufacturing bill, none of those have come up on the Senate floor, and there are a lot of people that are pretty much would say they don't expect Randy Richardville, Senate Majority Leader, to bring those up. I have a tendency to believe that that's yet to be seen at this point, but nothing's happened with that so far. So no big movement on the controversial ones. However, over in the House, there are other bills that are being introduced, and actually also in the Senate, that would deal with concealed weapons. This is an issue that we saw at the end of the year last year. Governor Snyder vetoed a bill that would allow concealed weapons in what are now considered no gun zones or gun-free zones under the concealed carry law,
right?
Like schools, churches, sporting events, bars, so forth. And we did see a bill introduced that is sort of an alternative to that. It would let schools opt in and say, under certain circumstances, we can let our employees or people with concealed permits, concealed weapons permits, enter our premises with a concealed weapon. And then we're also expecting Senator Green, who is a big supporter of some of these bills, to introduce basically the same legislation that the governor vetoed that would just open up these gun-free zones to concealed carry.
Think this could gain momentum?
It definitely, that bill did pass the legislature last year,
yeah.
So very much so, although it's yet to be seen whether Governor Snyder will be on board this time. I have a feeling he's probably more inclined to be interested in that schools bill that would let them opt in.
Good update. Appreciate that and appreciate your time. I know we'll be talking some more as we follow what's happening in Lansing. Talking with Jake Neer of the Michigan Public Radio Network, our state capitol reporter. Thanks so much, Jake.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Still to come, performer Sandra Bernhard's coming back to Michigan for a weekend of shows in Ann Arbor. But before that, she'll talk with us about growing up in Flint. Our conversation in 15 minutes. This is Stateside. Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, Sunday brings us Super Bowl 47, and even those of us who could really care less whether Baltimore or San Francisco emerges triumphant, a lot of us still pay attention to those commercials. The Super Bowl's become as much about the commercials as the actual game. And with the revived health of the auto industry, we can expect to see big offerings from the car companies. Well, at least most of them. Let's see how much those Super Bowl ads really matter and which company is sitting this one out. Joining us is Mike Bernacki, marketing professor at the University of Detroit Mercy, and from Michigan State University, Bob Colt. He's an instructor in the Department of Advertising, Public Relations, and Retailing. Mike, let's start with you. Everyone's already talking about the Volkswagen Come On Get Happy Jamaican ad, which leads me to wonder, doesn't it steal the thunder to release an ad before the actual Super Bowl?
Well, you know, that ad aside, that issue, of course, is always a piercing issue. But the answer to the question is, if you're paying somewhere between $3.8 million and $4 million for 30 seconds of advertising, increasingly the game is how much buzz, how much publicity, how much voice can you get before and after the game. So nobody could deny that there's certainly been buzz and publicity given that ad, and other ads as well. You know, it's called value, and they want to get as much value as they can from these ad spots.
Bob, just even us all seeing it beforehand, doesn't it take the kind of the wind out of the proverbial sails? What I can totally understand getting that out virally, Facebook, whatever, after its first run. But I guess you kind of wonder, why watch on Sunday?
No, Cynthia, this is not a state secret. We want to sell cars. We want people to see this. Don't think that leaking is a bad thing. I've been contacted by all the major PR companies, and everybody has who has an ad in the game, has a PR company, and is doing some sort of social media component. And that's what the American tradition has become. It is about promoting and selling products. And you mention who's in, who's out. That yeah. Volkswagen ad may be, or may not be controversial. I didn't really see any problem with it. But General Motors is out of the game this year, and I think that's a little disappointing to have a hometown favorite and hero sit on the sideline.
And why are they sitting this one out? Do they feel that the Super Bowl ad isn't worth the bang for the buck?
Well, here's the problem. They have spent a lot of money over the years, and General Motors has been a huge Super Bowl fan and advertiser. And to be out this year, they said, well, look, at just shy of $4 million is a little too much for one 30-second ad. And we're also going to cut back on Facebook ads. I think the real problem is that they haven't produced great spots in the past. Chrysler really invented the imported from Detroit campaign and premiered it in the Super Bowl. Executives at Chrysler said it had a direct impact on their image and sales. And this year, Ford's in the game rebranding Lincoln, which is going to be terrific. All of the other auto companies are racing to the Super Bowl, but, you know, I think part of General Motors' problem is they just didn't create any great ads that were Super Bowl worthy.
I think when we take a look at what GM has done, you know, it's amazing because they've gotten an extraordinary amount of publicity because they're not in the Super Bowl. Now, where else can you possibly get that kind of attention? So while they put out no Super Bowl ad money, in-game ad money, they've certainly been recognized. And, of course, the excuse, as Bob mentioned, that, you know, the ads are too pricey. Well, they are very pricey, but they've been willing to pay for those ads before. As a matter of fact, they have spent the third most dollars in Super Bowl advertising over the last 10 years, so behind Anheuser-Busch and PepsiCo. Having said that, you know, they're switching their strategy, and their strategy more is in line with globalness. For example, they now are a sponsor of Manchester United, the soccer team, of course, in England,
yes,
whose evaluation is the highest of any pro sports team at about $3 billion. So, you know, to go along with what they're doing, they're also switching their ad dollars more, promotional dollars more, to globalness.
Hey, Bob, as Mike knows, though, too, you know, we're going to have, as many of the estimates go up to 150 million people worldwide in some way, tuning in and watching the game. The Super Bowl delivers a bigger audience across all demographic groups than any TV program of the year. So is just shy of $4 million a good buy? Well, the argument can be made that it is, and it's good to have great advertising in the game. GM's advertising has not been hot in past games, and to be Super Bowl worthy, you really got to be funny. You got to be memorable. You got to make a sale.
Well, let me ask you this. When you look back at the history, guys, of car commercials in the Super Bowl, is there one commercial that in your mind stands out head and shoulders above the rest as far as effectiveness and telling the story? Was it the imported from Detroit with M&M?
Well, that was beautiful. You know, when Chrysler got on board with that ad and then followed up, of course, last year with its Halftime in America, what they did is they built value back into the 60-second and longer ad. Of course, both those ads last year and the year before were two-minute ads now, two-minute ads. We are going to see, because of that effect, because of that impact, as many longer ads, if not more longer ads, that is longer than 30 seconds, than we have at almost any other year. So they changed, if you will, the gridiron. They changed the plan on what was moving along, and, of course, they've been very successful. But it would be hard not to like that VW Darth Vader ad.
Oh, you know, yeah.
That achieved so much success. But I think that Chrysler really has changed the game, you know, for taking a look at Super Bowl ads. Guess what? Super Bowl I, 1967, were all 60-second ads. The 30-second ad was not part of the genre of Super Bowl of ads. Guess what? They're back thanks to Chrysler.
Yeah, and Chrysler did a great job. Their executives admitted that that ad in the Super Bowl began to turn around and directly have an impact on sales for the company. Usually, an executive's not going to go out on a limb and say that, but there were a lot of folks at Chrysler and certainly in Detroit, and certainly people in the city who said that ad changed the image of Detroit in a great way. And I think that's wonderful. Now, look, we've had long-form ads, and they've been terrific, and it's great that we tell a story. I remember when we had the Miller High Life, that ad that was 1 second long with just the beer guy saying, High Life. So you can have a 1 second ad. You can have a 2 minute ad. If you're in the game, it's a big stakes investment. So you can't do something little. You really have to be in the game competing and have your best product and foot forward. What we haven't seen this year, and I hate to say it, is that beer usually has some of the best creative, and beer doesn't leak their ads before the game.
No, so, but it foams.
So we're looking forward to, I think, what will be a good game led by the car companies at the front of the pack.
Now, let me ask you this, and as you've just joined us, we're talking with Mike Bernacki, who's professor of marketing at the University of Detroit Mercy, and Bob Colt, who's an instructor in the Department of Advertising, Public Relations, and Retailing at Michigan State. Bob, let me ask you this. Is there a risk that the buzziness, if I may use that word, about the commercial could overshadow the actual product? And what I'm going to refer to was from a few years back, the Celine Dion commercial for Chrysler. And my sense was people talked a whole lot more about Celine Dion singing Drive. And as for what she was driving, not so much.
Yeah, you can't just create buzz and not make a good, memorable spot that doesn't sell a product. And I don't know that that really sold the product. It was nice for Celine Dion, and we've had other celebrities from Britney Spears to Bob Dole to, you know, all kinds of people do spots in the Super Bowl, and the ad's really not about them. I remember when Michael Jackson really filmed the Pepsi spot that caught his hair on fire for the Super Bowl. You know, the ad is not about them. It's about making a sale and doing something that's memorable. I would tell you, they're not always, obviously, good ads. If you think about the movie ads, those are the worst ads in the Super Bowl, and they pay a high rate for these trailers from Sony and Disney and Paramount.
Now, why are they the worst?
Well, there are a lot of loud explosions and quick cuts, and they don't really tell you much of a story. They're not humorous. They're not necessarily funny. They don't have a gimmick, and really, if I were to tell an advertiser to save their money, I would tell those folks to buy around the game like GM is doing in the pregame rather than being in the top shelf, top price spots in the game.
Interesting. Of course,
it's been traditional to have those ads there, and they go ahead and do it. And I think this year, Iron Man 3 is going to have a 45-second ad. And I like what Bob said a lot because, indeed, the trailers are among the worst-rated ads every year. But we know, and you know, over the last 10 years, they've been a mainstay, and perhaps tradition has allowed them to continue. But the idea of putting them in the pregame and maybe in the postgame is a very worthwhile suggestion. By the way, how important are the autos this year? How about this? The pregame show is being sponsored, the kickoff show just before the ball hits the air, is being sponsored by Hyundai. The post-game show, who's that sponsored by? Well, the post-game show is Toyota. So it's wall-to-wall wheels from the kickoff show to the post-game show.
Interesting. And we shouldn't give short shrift to Ford. I know that this is the year, and I think you did touch on this, Bob, this is the year it's going to be all about Lincoln.
Yeah, and that's great. I mean, we want to see new things. We want to root for American automakers. And I think it's great for Ford to do that. I think they've got a real challenge in completely rebranding Lincoln. But from what I've seen already from the spots, they're going to do a good job, and I'll bet you they sell some product.
Will the Lincoln ad do better in the ad meet or other Super Bowl ratings than the movie will at the Oscars? stay tuned to be discovered.
Well, let me, in the last minute we have here, let me ask each of you, what are you most looking forward to seeing commercial-wise during the Super Bowl? Mike?
Well, you know, I food and drinks are a tradition, and I want to see if Anheuser-Busch, if Budweiser can, you know, rise to the occasion again like they used to. You know, they had the, gosh, they had the frogs and, you know, et cetera, and Bud Bowl years and years ago. And really, they've taken a back seat. So they buy more ad time than anybody else does. Are they going to be there? And then I wonder, with the plethora of auto ads, you know, how will everybody finish in the auto game? Because the auto, it's a very important product this year with a third consecutive year of an increasing economy. And let's face it, automakers want to succeed in this marketplace. So will Anheuser-Busch step up to the plate, be there at kickoff and succeed, or are they just going to have another monstrous ad buy?
I agree with Mike. I want beer in that game. I want to see how the autos race and who ends up at the finish line. I'm also excited about Pepsi and Coke and see who wins the soft drink competition. But I'll tell you, the best ads, the ones that I really like, are those Doritos fan-made ads, because it shows folks that anybody can have a good idea and put it onto film and into the Super Bowl and really, you know, create some buzz and sell some product. So I'm looking forward to Doritos.
We've been talking with Mike Bernacki of the University of Detroit Mercy and Bob Colt of Michigan State University. Thank you so much for joining us today, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us. Happy Super Bowl week as it continues.
Michigan welcomes one of its own back home this weekend. Sandra Bernhard's appearing at the Arc in Ann Arbor this Friday and Saturday. She's a comedian, she's an actor in film and television, a stage performer, a commentator, a musician, a writer. It goes on and on. And her roots go back to Flint. And Sandra Bernhard joins us now. Hi, Sandra.
Hi, how are you?
Very good. Well, listen, I'm wondering, as I kind of think about all the things you do and the kind of performer you are, how do you see yourself? What would you call yourself?
I would call myself an eclectic entertainer.
Yes, it's true. What are we going to be seeing at the Arc this weekend? What are you going to be bringing to us?
Well, you know, I've always described my act as sort of a mashup of rock and roll meets cabaret meets burlesque meets stand-up with a general entertaining, you know, overview. You know, it's a stream of consciousness. It's my monologues. It's personal. It's political. It's pop culture, all mashed together with great music. I have my band, the Flawless Zircons, who will be accompanying me. And the music's always dynamic and sexy. And, you know, you get a show, like, I guess it's akin to being in Berlin in 1939, before it all went wrong.
I want to ask you a little about growing up in Flint and your memories of that. You were there until you were, what, about 10?
10, yeah.
Good times?
It's great times. You know, Flint was at its peak. GM, you know, Fisher, all the auto industry was really cranking at full gear. And my father was a doctor and, you know, did quite well. It was a small town, and yet it wasn't too crushing. I mean, you got to meet new people. Some of the kids, you know, I still know today, obviously. Small Jewish community, but very vibrant.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a great time to grow up. You run around the streets, you walk to school by yourself. It was a different time in the world, and certainly a different time in America. And, of course, the Midwest has a certain intimacy and family-oriented vibe that, you know, I think still kind of radiates today.
And as you see the way things have been, especially since the Great Recession and Flint really has, you know, been hit hard. Yeah, what does that make you feel when you're back home?
Well, you know, I'm coming in tomorrow early. I'm actually going with my friend Harry Kirschbaum, who still lives in Michigan. We were in kindergarten together. He's going to take me up to Flint, and we're going to spend the day there. And I've actually made a really good friend on Twitter, this artist named Sean Colton, and he and his wife and autistic son live in Flint. And we've become very good friends over Twitter, but I haven't met him yet. So tomorrow's the first day I'm meeting him, and he's actually a singer as well, so he's going to come and do a song with me at the Arc either Friday or Saturday night. So this is like kind of a funny, interesting, you know, loving situation that has evolved with a Flint brother. So I'm really excited about coming in tomorrow and, you know, tooling around. I mean, I can still see my house on Zillow. You know, I punch in my address on Concord Street. It comes up, built in 1955. You know, it's just so, and you see it. And of course, it's so strange. I mean, how the world has completely, you know, been turned on its ear since we left Flint when I was 10 years old.
Yeah. So looking ahead to what you're going to be doing, Sandra Bernhardt, at the Arc Friday and Saturday, this coming weekend, what's kind of on your mind? What's bubbling on the front burner that you want to make sure that you're going to be bringing into your show?
Well, you know, certainly, you know, some political things, you know, handled gingerly.
Such as?
Well, you know, I mean, I guess there's a little bit about gun control. There's a little bit about just the obvious stuff. But I touch very lightly on that because I really feel like it's also so over-examined every night, you know, between, you know, Rachel Maddow and you know, all the guys, Stephen Colbert. So I try not to get too, like, dead-on political, but, you know, I touch on things. And then sort of just like it's kind of a roadmap of places I've been recently, you know, ranging from a party out in Hollywood over the holidays to, like, motherhood, and some stories are fictionalized, some stories are real. I've always kind of played with that and toyed with, like, what, you know, the fine line between my life and what I want in my life. So you're never really 100% sure if a story is true or not, which is kind of my signature.
Sandra Bernhardt, thank you for talking with us, and welcome back to Michigan.
It's my pleasure.
And up next, the Great Lakes at their lowest levels in decades. What effect could it have on the economy? That story next here on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Let's turn now to our Great Lakes, specifically water levels. The Great Lakes are at their lowest levels in decades, so much so that Governor Snyder says emergency action is needed.
There's going to be a need to do some, what I would describe as emergency dredging, to make sure we keep it open for commerce, for tourism, for many other issues, and that's something we need to be discussing.
The governor says he'll give more details about his emergency plan during his budget presentation next week. So let's get a better understanding of just how bad things are.
Certainly in Lakes Michigan and Huron, they're at some all-time low levels here for this time of year. So it's very serious. Superior is also down. And so throughout the upper Great Lakes, there's a lot of concern here. Obviously, it affects a lot of different economic sectors in our region, and it has impacts for, you know, virtually all parts of our quality of life here.
That's Al Steinman, director of the Annis Water Resources Institute at Grand Valley State University. And Al, before we talk about the fixes to this problem, first, help us understand, what are the causes?
I think there are a number of different factors that are all contributing. And I also think it would probably be presumptuous to say which one is most important, because they all affect each other and they interact in different sorts of ways. But one is, you know, we've had milder winters. The last 30 years, we've seen increases in our air temperature, which also is reflected in our water temperatures. And as a consequence, we have less ice cover on our Great Lakes. And when there's less ice that's over the lakes, there's more chance for evaporation. And so we're seeing more loss of water as it enters into the atmosphere and then gets moved into different parts of the globe.
That's
certainly one effect. Secondly, we've been in a drought, you know, for a fair number of years now, and so we're getting less precipitation falling on our landscape and falling directly on the lakes themselves. So when you combine that with, you know, hot summers, more evaporation, less water coming into the lakes, overall we have a reduction in what we call our net basin supply. That is the net amount of water into our Great Lakes. And I think, you know, those two contributing factors are certainly the primary sources of our low water levels. There's a lot of talk about, you know, water going out into the Chicago Sanitary and Shipping Canal. You know, are we shipping water out? And those are very, very minor components in our overall water budget. And, you know, while they may contribute in a very small fashion, those are not the kind of things that are contributing to our record low water levels.
And it's interesting. We actually had U of M professor Rosina Bierbaum in here last week talking about the big climate assessment report. And I got the strong sense in talking to her that these causes you're talking about, they're really not going to go away. So we need to learn to adapt. We aren't going to eliminate, as you say, these the drought and the milder winters. This is the new reality. Does that strike you as correct?
Yes, absolutely. You know, for a while there, I think we probably deceived ourselves into thinking mitigation steps might be able to handle this. But I'm sure, as Rosina mentioned, there is so much of this impact in our climate, in our atmosphere, that it will be carried forward into the future. That really trying to deal with stopping this and mitigating it is no longer realistic, and now it's a matter of adapting to the changes that we're going to see in our future. And this could be adaptation in terms of what kind of crops we grow. It could be adaptation in terms of our human health. It could be adaptations in terms of our infrastructure. You know, we see this particularly in tragedies like the storm Sandy, mm-hmm. Where you're looking at the New York metropolitan area talking about huge investments in order to deal with sea level rise. Well, we may be looking at similar types of investments like harbor dredging for our future to deal with these kinds of impacts.
And that leads me into if you were the doctor writing the prescription for this problem of great problem of low water levels on the Great Lakes, what would your prescription be?
Well, I think there's a couple of things, and you know, really it depends on, you know, what kind of impacts you're talking about, because there'll be different prescriptions depending upon different sectors. And I don't think that if you want to really stretch the medical analogy, I don't think that's any different than medicine. You know, there's mm-hmm. not one type of lifestyle change that's going to benefit everybody. It's going to depend upon what your symptoms are.
Sure.
And so I think, you know, this is... You know, this really meshes well with when we talk about what society can do, because I think there are short-term fixes, there are long-term fixes, and we need to look at both, and nothing is going to cure this overnight. And when we look at the problem, we have to address both the symptoms and the disease itself. We can't look just at the symptoms. So, for example, if we're looking at harbor dredging in order to increase our access, if we had the money, we could spend money every year and dredge out those sediments that are clogging our harbors and, you know, presumably get the kind of navigation that we need. But by doing so, we're not looking at the disease. We're only looking at the symptom, and that's not a really sustainable kind of cure for the future. So what I would argue is, yes, we need to dredge. Mm-hmm. We need to find the dollars to do that, and there's a couple of reasons why. You know, this problem has been exacerbated over the last few years, and we can talk about that. But in addition to finding those dollars, getting the dredging that's absolutely necessary for these harbors, we need to look at some of the other long-term causes. One is lower water levels associated with climate. But another one is the source of the sediment that's clogging the harbors. And we're mm-hmm. getting sediment coming off of our landscape. And that is being affected by the way that we use our land. And those land use changes associated either with agriculture, construction, whatever, that's increasing the amount of sediment load into our rivers, which work their way down into our harbors, are contributing to the problem as well.
So essentially it's like fat clogging your arteries if you're living on a high-fat diet.
That's right. So you need a combination of changing your diet as well as more exercise in order to regain good health, and that's what we need to do with our harbors. We need to look at our how we're using our land, make sure that we're using wise, low-impact development strategies, minimizing the amount of sediment running off of our landscapes into our waterways, and then in the meantime, you know, do some dredging, because historically, there's natural sediment that's always occurring. I mean, that's mm-hmm. feeding our rivers, and that we don't want to stop that, because that helps deliver some of the nutrients into our basins, which help fuel our fisheries. But a lot of the sediment load is unnatural, and okay. that's what we want to control. We build riparian buffer strips along our waterways to keep the sediment from getting into the rivers. We have different kinds of sediment retainment structures. We put in rain gardens, all sorts of these low-impact development strategies that help keep the sediment out of our waterways.
And Al, isn't it true some of these canals and waterways and harbors literally haven't been dredged in decades?
Well, it varies depending upon which kind of harbor you're dealing with. Now, some of them have been, you know, are eligible for federal dollars. And the problem is that, you know, those dollars have dried up. We don't have the kinds of earmarks that used to be allowed in Congress, which went towards some of these dredging actions. So those have dried up, and that's a real problem. When you look at how much money has been historically appropriated relative to what the needs are for these harbors, it's horribly less than what has been requested, and it's getting worse and worse in terms of that discrepancy. And that's why the governor's looking towards this kind of emergency dredging action to try and deal with this, and maybe get members of Congress to support a recent bill, the Realize America's Maritime Promise Act, which could perhaps fix the long-term challenge of finding funding for dredging the harbors. And so that's something that I think the governor's office and the Office of Great Lakes will try and push in the future, which makes perfect sense because, I'm biased because I live on one of these harbors.
Sure.
But really, this is part of the lifeblood of Michigan's economy, the Great Lakes economy. And whether it's recreational use of these harbors or whether it's commercial use, we need to get these boats and ships in and out of these harbors. And dredging is the reality that's part of that.
Al, thanks for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
Al Steinman is the director of the Annis Water Resources Institute at Grand Valley State University. When you think of making a living in the music business, chances are places like New York, LA, or maybe Nashville jump to mind. But what are the chances of making your mark and making a living in music and being able to stay right here in Michigan? And with schools having to cut spending all too often, music finds itself on the chopping block. So where will tomorrow's musicians in Michigan really come from? We turn to a man who has put Michigan on the map in the music world. After founding Yessian Music in the early 1970s, Dan Yessian's gone on to produce music heard around the world for commercials, TV shows, Super Bowl and Sunday Night Football, museums, theme parks, and much more. And he has done it without leaving Michigan. Pleasure to welcome Dan Yessian to the studios.
Thank you for having me, Cynthia.
So, Dan, if you were to ask most young musicians, how would you like to make a living in music? I'm guessing they would talk about record deals and becoming recording stars or playing with a band and standing on a stage. Would I be right?
Partially, but there are so many other avenues to make music. And obviously, you've cited some of the things that we've done, whether it's teaching music, whether it's writing music for commercials, whether it's writing music for TV shows. There are a lot of areas.
Well, your career really does shed light on really a more unseen but a huge, huge part of music. So talk to us about exactly what you do based here in Michigan at Yessian Studios.
We started out doing primarily music for commercial, and that would be where the advertising agency comes to us and says, we'd like you to create a 30-second, I hate to use the word ditty, but that's kind of what it is.
For people who are listening who might be parents of hopeful young musicians or musicians themselves who are listening, mm-hmm. What does it take to launch the kind of business that you've been able to build?
It takes some blindness so that you don't know all the competition that you're really in front of. It does take a good knowledge base, a good music education. It just takes a lot of perseverance. And when I say blind, being hopeful that you can break through this thing. It took many years. First 10 years of my life doing this, we were not that successful, to be very, very honest with you. But along the way, you had a certain breaks, come along. We started doing bigger national work for commercials. And then later on, found ourselves doing music for television shows. We've done music for, in the early years, we started doing some work for Sesame Street and Electric Company, which was very exciting for me because as a previously trained school teacher as well, mm-hmm. I taught in the public schools, not music, mm-hmm. speech and English, which is a long story. But having done that for Sesame Street, it was near and dear to me as a teacher. So doing that kind of thing and doing later on music for TV shows like NCIS and promos for The Voice and Revolution and Law and Order.
Law and Order LA.
Very exciting things, but as time went on, my sons got involved, Brian and Michael Yessian, and were able to parlay this even further beyond the gates of Michigan into New York and Los Angeles and now Germany, Hamburg, Germany.
It's much easier, I'm sure, today with digital music and being able to share files, but I bet at the beginning, it was tapes were being mailed and things were
it was a
different world.
Yeah, it was reel-to-reel tapes, three-quarter-inch videos. Nothing like today. The technology has really advanced us into places that I would have never foreseen.
Does so it that make, means opportunity
it means
for
opportunity.
Youngsters today.
It absolutely means opportunity. And, you know, you want to see more of that in the public schools as well. That from time to time suffers as a result of cutbacks with music and education. But there is such a benefit to music programs in the schools that I would hope that they take more advantage of it, but that doesn't seem to always happen.
Well, one wonders if, for example, instrumental music has to be cut because a district is strapped for cash. Where would tomorrow's musicians come from?
I think tomorrow's musicians, for starters, have to come from the family unit. I think it's important that there's an encouraging going on with whomever is in the household, mom, dad, whatever. As an example, my mother was insistent that I took music lessons. There was a man that was going from door to door selling music lessons. Now, this is kind of unheard of these days. Mm-hmm. But he said, rang the doorbell and said, would your son like to take music lessons? And she said, yes, come on in. In any case, long story short, I ended up taking music lessons for $2.50 weekly. Mm-hmm. And I think it's on a parent's onus to be able to encourage their kids to do that, not so they can become a rock star, so they can do what I'm doing. The motivation should be for kids to be able to say, I can do this, I can be a part of a group. Music is a wonderful thing. It's a great release, it's a creative release, it inspires emotion. And it gives you the ability to be able to communicate in ways that you couldn't if you weren't taking music lessons.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Dan Yessian, who's a noted composer based in Michigan. His work is heard across the country and around the world. You talked a little earlier about the technology, and it strikes me that young people today, I would suspect your average 13 or 14-year-old with a good keyboard and a little bit of computer equipment could probably make music that you weren't able to make without a full orchestra when you were starting out.
That's true, but I'm also suggesting that same child take lessons to understand the mechanics of music and how it works. I think it's terribly important because too often they rely so much on ear that they are actually suppressing themselves from being able to do something even more expansive than that. I'm an ear musician, but that's not a bad thing, but I think that you still have to have some education feature built into this that helps you develop in ways that you didn't think you could before.
But there certainly seems, as you say, there's so much benefit that people don't think about in terms of developing the brain and developing the heart and the soul and the brain.
Absolutely, yeah.
Dan Yessian, what's on the horizon for you?
For me, I'm in the back room these days writing my little songs. I've always been interested in music from a songwriting perspective, so now I get to do that because I'm currently off the hot seat of business because both Brian and Michael are doing that, and I'm making my journeys to L.A. and to New York. Where we do have offices, but I visit record companies.
With
songs in hand. I'm back to peddling my music, but in a different way now. I've always had a love and a desire to create music. So I could never retire. My wife wouldn't want me to retire because she would get very upset. We could probably do damage to each other if I was staying at home with her. So
stay in the studio.
That's what I'm doing.
Dan Yessian, good to know you, and thanks for sharing your insights with us on Stateside.
Thank you very much, Cynthia.
And here on Stateside, we'd love to hear from you. You can find us online at michiganradio.org. Go to Facebook, search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. And, of course, we're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. The executive producer of Stateside is Zoe Clark. Our show today was produced and directed by Mercedes Mejia. And our engineer today was Peg Watson. Our contributors are Allie Billings, Maya Friedman, Emily Fox, and Cameron Stewart. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening. And let's talk again Monday afternoon at 3:00.